Hey, all. Welcome back to the Real Life Pharmacology Podcast. I'm your host, pharmacist Eric Christensen. Thank you so much for listening today. Before we get into this special episode, definitely want to remind you guys to go check out reallifepharmacology.com. Get your free 31-page PDF on the top 200 drugs. It's a great study guide, great refresher if you got board exams coming up, or if you've been out in practice for a while and want to catch up on what the top 200 drugs are. Simply an email will get you access to that and also get you signed up for when we have new podcasts and other content available. So go do that at reallifepharmacology.com. All right, so the special episode today, and this is part one of two, is the Beers criteria. I wanted to highlight some of the most important things that I've seen in practice in relation to the Beers criteria. So this isn't absolutely everything within the Beers criteria. First and foremost, just taking a step back, what is the Beers criteria for those of you that may not be familiar with it? It is a list of potentially inappropriate medications for use in the elderly. So really, a list of drugs that by and large, for the most part, we should really try to, at a minimum, we should really try to avoid using these medications, if at all possible. So, with that stated, with that introduction, let's get into the medications. So, first off, I have first-generation antihistamines. The medication I by far see used the most by patients is diphenhydramine. I probably see it used most often for sleep. Not a great medication, not a very geriatric-friendly medication. There are plenty of others in this category as well that are listed in the Beers criteria. Doxylamine, chlorpheniramine, meclizine, promethazine, hydroxyzine. And the primary reason why they are on the Beers criteria is they have numerous adverse effects. Confusion, obviously very problematic in elderly patients, especially our patients with dementia. Fall risk, these medications have been associated with inducing delirium, as well as some of the sedative properties the medication has. It also can prevent people from seeing, peeing, pooping, and spitting. So dry mouth, dry eyes, constipation, and urinary retention, kind of hallmark symptoms of anticholinergic medications. There is a caveat written in here. For instance, in severe allergic reactions, it's definitely reasonable and appropriate to use a medication like diphenhydramine. But by and large, most indications, you know, general, you know, seasonal allergies, sleep purposes, these medications definitely are not recommended to use, if at all possible, in our geriatric patient population. All right, number two, I've got nitrofurantoin. This medication is historically used for urinary tract infections. It is recommended to avoid this medication for long-term UTI prophylaxis, particularly in patients with a creatinine clearance less than 30 mils. This drug can accumulate, and the longer it's used, we do have some longer-term adverse effects in addition to short-term adverse effects. And some of those risks include pulmonary toxicity. So nitrofurantoin is one of the unique medications that can cause some lung toxicity, amiodarone being another one, of course. Peripheral neuropathy, so it can cause some neuropathic-type pain and issues there. And hepatotoxicity is also listed as a risk there. So, again, as that renal function declines, we need to be paying more and more attention to nitrofurantoin and trying to avoid its use there. Aspirin prevention. So, in secondary prevention, you know, patients had a heart attack, stroke, things of that nature, aspirin absolutely is appropriate. However, in primary prevention, looking at initiating aspirin for that primary prevention risk, it is generally not recommended. There's, you know, higher risk of bleeding as patients age, and the evidence of benefit tends to drop as patients get older as well, or we don't have as great of literature demonstrating that there really is much benefit to it. So generally, in geriatric patients, we're going to avoid starting aspirin for primary prevention. If you've got patients on it and they've been on it for a long time, you're probably going to weigh the risk versus benefit of deprescribing, basically getting rid of that aspirin in that type of situation. And for many patients, we may elect to stop that based upon bleed risk and other risk factors and, you know, potential benefit side of things too there. All right, we got warfarin. In non-valvular atrial fibrillation and VTE treatment, it is not a preferred agent. So newer agents like the DOACs, apixaban, for example, these are preferred. There's an increased risk for intracranial bleeding. Obviously, tons of drug interactions and issues with warfarin as well. If one of the hard situations that I run into in my practice is maybe you've had a patient on warfarin for 10, 15, 20 years, kind of prior to this newer evidence on some of the newer DOACs. If they've been on warfarin, if they're very, very stable, if they're not having issues, it is reasonable to continue them on that warfarin. But obviously, if, you know, INRs are fluctuating, they're having issues, they're having bleeding problems, we've had plenty of concerns with that warfarin in that patient, that's definitely a situation where you're probably going to switch them over to a DOAC. So kind of a challenging gray situation there, depending upon kind of the stability and how well they've done with warfarin. Rivaroxaban, while we're on this topic, in long-term atrial fibrillation, VTE, older age, there is a higher risk for major bleeding and GI bleeding there, generally more so than apixaban. So generally, I would say from most clinicians' perspective, I've seen most prefer apixaban. Really, the biggest downside probably to apixaban over rivaroxaban is it is dosed twice daily. So if that is a major, major concern with your patient, taking a second dose in the day, then rivaroxaban might be a reasonable alternative to apixaban. But in general, if patients don't have that issue, you're probably going to lean towards apixaban due to some of those higher risks there. Let's continue on cardiovascular medications. Non-selective alpha blockers, I guess they're maybe more of a urology medication as well, kind of a dual indication there. Non-selective alpha blockers should not be used for hypertension management, okay? They cause significant orthostatic hypotension, obviously could lead to dizziness, falls, things of that nature. And the evidence of benefit from compelling indications and things of that nature, you know, reduction in stroke or, you know, reducing issues with renal function, we really don't have those compelling indications with alpha blockers like we do with other medications. Heart failure is another one there where you've got compelling indications with, you know, ACE inhibitors and, you know, benefits with diuretics, for example. Those don't really exist with alpha blockers. So, again, not a ton of benefit in addition to the blood pressure lowering effects. And then we've got the excessive risks of orthostatic hypotension with those non-selective alpha blockers like prazosin, tirazosin, and medications like that. Another antihypertensive medication is the central alpha agonist. That would be clonidine, probably being the most common medication there. We've got drop in pulse. We've got orthostasis risk. We've got potential confusion and CNS effects. So definitely a medication that you generally want to avoid for the management of hypertension. Another cardiovascular medication, we've got amiodarone. This medication is not recommended to be used as a first-line agent in atrial fibrillation. There may be some exceptions there if we've got compelling indications like heart failure or left ventricular hypertrophy, but definitely a medication to generally avoid due to numerous toxicities. We've got QTC prolongation risk. We've got, I mentioned pulmonary toxicity with nitrofurantoin there as well. Thyroid toxicity can happen. It can cause some hypothyroidism. I've certainly seen that in practice. And hepatotoxicity, so liver toxicity is an issue there as well as some of the CYP3A4 drug interactions and things of that nature too. So amiodarone, definitely a challenging medication. It does need to be used occasionally where we don't have other options, but generally a medication to avoid there if possible. Another cardiovascular medication, I guess classified as an antiarrhythmic, is digoxin. So just recently had a situation or case with digoxin toxicity, or at least potential for digoxin toxicity. You got to remember, this drug can accumulate as renal function declines, and we see that renal function decline as patients age. So really, if it's going to be used, really got to be paying attention to that renal function and making sure that drug isn't accumulating. Because like I said, I've seen a fair number of cases of digoxin toxicity where that renal function declined, the drug accumulated, patients started displaying, nausea and vomiting and weight loss. And if that level gets high enough, they can actually display some visual disturbances as well. So with this medication, avoid this as a first-line agent for rate control and atrial fibrillation. Also avoid as a first-line medication in heart failure as well. So, again, definitely pay attention to that. And we also, in geriatric patients, want to avoid dosages greater than 0.125 milligrams per day. So I have seen 0.25 milligrams, so that's a pretty steep dose. Beer's criteria recommends not using that dose for sure, so don't go above 0.125 milligrams per day. And that may even be too high in some patients that may have that worsening renal function. All right, let's switch gears here and go to maybe some neurology and psych type medications. So TCAs. And paroxetine. So we've got some antidepressants. So TCAs are amitriptyline, nortriptyline, for example. Paroxetine is an SSRI, but these agents have significant anticholinergic activity. So I alluded to that kind of in the opening there, where you've got constipation, dry eyes, dry mouth, urinary retention, confusion, sedation, fall risk, delirium. All those potential adverse effects can happen. These medications also have been associated with dropping blood pressure too a little bit. So that's an important thing to note too, kind of in association with that fall risk. Medications used for Parkinson's, we've got benztropine and trihexafenidyl. These are actually very, very old agents that were used for Parkinson's disease. Now, where I've seen them most used in clinical practice is for the management of extrapyramidal symptoms from the use of antipsychotics. So, haloperidol, risperidone, for example. It is generally recommended to avoid these medications for that purpose. And it is definitely recommended to avoid those medications for use in Parkinson's disease. Very, very anticholinergic, can exacerbate confusion, delirium, and some of those symptoms kind of display sometimes in Parkinson's themselves. So definitely pay attention to that and generally avoid those medications if possible. With that, let's shift to antipsychotics, which I kind of alluded to, and why you may see benztropine or trihexafenidyl used. So antipsychotics carry that risk of increased mortality, and there is a boxed warning. So there's been associations with increased risk of mortality, like I mentioned, but also increased risk of stroke as well. So antipsychotics should be avoided, if at all possible, for behavioral symptoms associated with dementia. So try non-pharmacologic interventions. We also need to recognize that there are situations where those non-pharmacological interventions fail to manage those behavioral issues. If that is the case, and if you are considering using an antipsychotic for hallucinations and aggression and things of that nature, you really want to make sure that those issues are harmful to the patient or to potentially others. So an example that I remember coming across in my practice is patient was basically hallucinating that their grandchildren were there in the room with them. And it was overall a pleasant experience for that patient. That's the type of hallucination that, as long as it's not leading to any issues or concerns and not causing the patient harm and distress or anybody else, that's a situation where I don't believe it would be a good idea or appropriate to increase the patient's risk of stroke and mortality, basically, to manage those hallucinations that aren't distressing to them. So really, really important that you do that assessment and you recognize if those behavioral issues are harmful to the patient or to others, and then obviously making sure that those non-drug interventions have been tried and actually failed prior to use. All right, I've got two more classes of medications that I want to cover, in particularly to anxiety and insomnia. So, of course, we've got benzodiazepines. These medications obviously have risk for addiction, dependence. They can increase the risk of respiratory depression, particularly when used with opioids. They can increase the risk for falls and confusion. Also, if you do have patients that are older that are driving, or anyone that's driving, I guess, for that matter, these medications have actions very similar to alcohol. So it can certainly impair cognition and impact the functioning of somebody who's driving a motor vehicle, for example. So definitely important to pay attention to that. So some of the most common examples used in practice, lorazepam, alprazolam, clonazepam or Klonopin, those are some of the most common examples there. Some are longer acting than others, which can be worse generally in our geriatric patient population that can certainly linger for a longer period of time. Of the more common ones, diazepam is probably one of the worst ones that's used somewhat common. It has a really, really long half-life and is more likely to accumulate and cause issues kind of in the long term there. So that's definitely one that's maybe a little bit more problematic than something like lorazepam, for example. And then kind of continuing in the same vein, we've got the Z drugs. So that's a drug like Zolpidem, for example, used for sleep. Again, these can increase the risk for confusion, obviously sedation. That's what we're using it for. But obviously increase that fall risk. So these are definitely problematic medications that you generally want to avoid if possible in our geriatric patient population. All right, well, that's going to wrap up the part one of the Beers criteria. Hopefully you picked up a few practice pearls. If you did today, please do me a favor. Leave a rating, review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. Greatly appreciate that. Support our sponsor, MedEd101.com/store. If you're in the market for any board certification study material, like the geriatrics exam, the BCGP exam, BCPS, ambulatory care, NAPLEX, lots of different study materials there. We've got lots of books available as well. Kind of a classic one in relation to geriatrics and the Beers criteria. As Perils of Polypharmacy, where I talk a lot about some of these issues within the geriatric scope and, you know, deprescribing and things of that nature. So go check all that out. If you got any comments, feedback on the podcast, feel free to reach out to me at mededucation101@gmail.com. You can track me down on LinkedIn as well. Eric Christensen, PharmD, BCPS, BCGP. All right, I'm going to sign off for today. Thank you all for listening. Take care, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.